Okay, I'm going to start with my second lecture on Darwin. And really, this lecture is about the connections between Darwin or Darwin's ideas of what has come to be called evolutionary psychology, although I will be concentrating much more on Darwin because, in my view, Darwin is much more profound than many of the psychologists today who can call themselves evolutionary psychologists, and I want to say why. Because it's very easy to make hypotheses and say, oh, young men have inherited the capacity to drive fast, and young women have inherited the capacity to dress up smartly and attract people and so on. It's so easy to say this, but it doesn't mean it's true. Darwin is concentrating, and he looks at humans, on inherited behaviour. What is it that have we inherited from our ancestors as a result of being human? And I particularly want to concentrate on Darwin's theory of the emotions. Why we act as we do when we are said to have particular emotions. Because there's big implications from Darwin's perspective of how to study and how to explain behaviour. And look, I'm using the word behaviour to start with. I'm not talking about cognition, because with Darwin, we've got a shift from looking at the mind, as Locke tried to do, as Hobbes tried to do, to looking at behaviour. Why is... Oh, I forgot. Okay. That's what I should be doing today. Now, with Darwin, we have the start of a very different sort of psychology. A different way of posing questions and what counts as answers to questions. You see, the normal explanation of human motivation is in terms of what the individual wants to do. Hobbes. Why do people behave like they do? Because they want to just get an advantage. They don't trust their neighbours. They want to do better than their neighbours and so on. It's all back to the individual, what the individual wants to do. Why have you chosen to study psychology? Oh, because I want to do something which interests me, or I want to have a good career, or my friend told me this and so on. It comes back to the individual. Why do you do this? I do it because. But with Darwin, suddenly the question has changed. Can you explain what the individual does? Not in terms of that individual, but in terms of the history of the whole species. Why do you act like this? I do it because I'm a human being. And us human beings, we're programmed to act like this. Why? Because our ancestors acted like this. And Darwin, throughout his writings on humans, and The Origin of Species was not a writing about humans, it came after then, throughout his writings on humans, was really stressing the importance of inherited characteristics. Very different from Locke. Locke, it's all nurture. We're born empty, and we create ourselves through our own experience. practices. But Darwin is saying, no, we are like we are, not because of our experiences, because of experiences thousands upon thousands of years ago. And you can see this is a sensational turning about of the questions of psychology, of why we behave as we do. And it leaves psychology with this fundamental problem which has not been resolved to this day. It's this question of nature and nurture, which is how much of human behaviour is to be explained in terms of inheritance. We behave, we act as we do because we're born to act in this way. And how much is to be explained in terms of learning? Obviously, you can't explain everything in terms of inheritance. Different cultures have different customs, different languages, different ways of doing things. And children learn the culture in which they're being brought up in. But we can ask the question, if we look across cultures, are there constancies? Something about being human means we have cultures which have particular patterns. There's the question, the nature-nurture question. And Darwin finally was able to conquer his reluctance, his inhibitions, his problems with his dear wife, and write about humans and evolution in his great book, The Descent of Man, published in 1871, where he took head on that humans had evolved and evolved from primates, from monkeys, from chimpanzees. And in so doing, he was applying the principles which we would say of animal psychology to humans. He was saying, all this which I found out about how animals evolved also applies to humans, and it's not a trivial finding. And Darwin was always looking at the similarities between humans and animals. But for Darwin, the similarities went both ways. Because he was saying, we just evolved apes, chimpanzees. There are similarities between us and the chimpanzees. But it cut both ways. He was saying, look at the higher mammals. Look at apes. You'll see they're very human. He's not making the comparison necessary to put us down and say we're just apes. He's saying also the higher mammals, they have feelings. Dogs, he said, you can tell when a dog is happy and when it's sad. They're like us in some ways. And there's this question, what have we inherited from our animal ancestors? And of course, what haven't we? What separates us from the other animals? And Darwin was not blind to the idea that humans were very different in many ways to the other animals. He thought we were the great achievement of evolution, the most noble species, because we have poetry, we have language, we have developed morality and science. And all the time, to sustain his arguments, he's looking for similarities. The similarities between humans and animals, and the similarities between humans. if we have evolved as a species, and if this history of evolution affects us in the present, and affects us in important ways, then it will affect all humans, all societies. And Darwin was aware that if evolution is important, it will be as important to the European as to the African, as to the South American, as to the Asian, and so on. There will be something linking all of us human beings as human beings. Bear this in mind, because next week I shall be talking about Francis Galton, who took the opposite conclusion and thought evolutionary theory went the other way. And the big question for Darwin and the descent of man is, what is human nature? What is it we've inherited from our ancestors which makes us humans? And remember, there were two, I've discussed two very different views of human nature. Those Hobbes's. It's in our nature to be suspicious, to compete, to struggle. In some ways, Hobbes's vision of the world was very similar to Darwin's. The struggle for existence. Each person is struggling to survive. Only the strongest, the most cunning, the one who looks after their interests, own interest best, will survive in this war of all against all. Sounds very much like Darwin talking about the struggle for existence, as the offspring struggle to get the food from the mother, as different creatures struggle to survive against their predators and so on. And that element would suggest, biologically, competition is rooted in our being. And it's rather an unpleasant vision. On the other hand, there was Shaftesbury saying, no. This is all wrong. It's in our nature to be social. We are social beings. Babies could not survive. We would not have, we would not be able to perpetuate ourselves if kindness weren't there, if there weren't a sense of morality, a sense of social being. Because who would look after the babies? And Darwin has a theory about humans, what we're like before we became humans, or as we were developing civilization, complex society. And was his image like Hobbes, stressing selfishness and competition, or was it like Shaftesbury? And like the previous philosophers, he had no direct evidence. There is no direct evidence of what humans were like, how we lived, just as we were becoming humans, as we were evolving from chimpanzees into the upright stance of the modern Homo erectus, Homo sapiens. No direct evidence. It involves a work of imagination. Does anyone want to hazard a guess whether Darwinian theory says it's a struggle of all against all, a competition, or that we are innately social? Does Darwin come down on the side of Hobbes or of Shaftesbury? Anyone shout out?
Hobbes.
There's one for Hobbes. Anyone want to shout out Shaftesbury? Or is everyone going to say Hobbes? we only have one vote for Hobbes, and silence means assent. You're all Hobbesians. Okay. Clues for Darwin. You can't go back in time, you can't rerun what happened a million years ago. You look at our closest neighbours. You look at the chimpanzees. And what distinguishes chimpanzees and makes them like humans. Not just that they have rather large brains and they can hold things in their hands. They're social animals. They live together. Chimpanzees do not like living alone. For Darwin, who spent time in the zoo, London Zoo, watching the chimpanzees there, this means that our ancestors probably had very social instincts. This is not a vote for Hobbes. Here's a quote. In order that primeval men, this is the earliest men, or the ape-like progenitors of man should have become social, they must have acquired the same instinctive feelings, as chimpanzees, and the same altogether. Now here's typical Darwin. He imagines what it's like to be an early man, an early human. They would have felt uneasy when separated from their comrades, for whom they would have felt some degree of love. They would have warned each other of danger and have given mutual aid in attack or defence. All this implies some degree of sympathy, fidelity, faith, and courage. So he's imagining these bands of groups of early humans, not quite yet evolved into proper humans. If one was attacked, all would seek to protect them. One would try and give warning signs for the group, as if the group was important. And none of this would be possible if those early humans instinctively were just selfish, looking after themselves. And why? Why? Human beings are not equipped with great speed. We don't survive because we can outrun predators. We're not the strongest animal. We can't tear flesh apart like lions and tigers can. But what we have, which enables us to survive, is a strength through sociality. We can warn each other of danger. The group can attack a predator. The group can seek to outwit a predator. And this is Darwin's argument. The more socially minded the group, the better chance of survival. And the better the chance of survival, the better the chance of reproducing that characteristic. So the group which is socially minded will have a better chance of perpetuating that trait of being socially minded, because it enables the individuals within the species to adapt to the situation in which they find themselves. Do you understand the argument of why he's arguing that for humans, for primates, for chimpanzees, for monkeys, some sort of social feeling is not just something desirable and immoral, morally desirable, but it will aid the survival of this type of animal. And so we have evolved to be social because it enables us to survive and therefore procreate, and procreate those who are socially minded. Those who are just selfish will not survive. And Darwin says these early feelings for the group, a warning of danger, for protecting your fellows, for feeling for your fellows, feeling some sort of early sort of love. He said, not only are evolutionary significant and advantageous, but they're the early social feelings of morality. And as human beings evolved into humans and evolved into the species with language, so these early feelings of community developed into language, into morality. Because you need language for morality as such, to say something is good, something is bad, you shouldn't do this. And so what Darwin was saying is there is an instinctive basis for humans to be moral and social. A vote, I'm afraid, for Shaftesbury. And of course Shaftesbury had said, not that he had any idea of evolution, Shaftesbury had said, there is a moral sense, or humans have a moral sense. And Darwin, over 100 years later, was saying something very similar, but backing it up with as good evidence as was available at that time. Now, in The Descent of Man, Darwin also addresses another question, which to us might seem odd, but to the Victorians, the Western European Victorians, was very, very important. It was a question, do humans constitute one species, or are there many biologically different sorts of humans? This is a racist question, there's no doubt about that. And the question arose from European imperialism, as the Europeans during the 18th and particularly the 19th century went across the world and annexed vast territories, conquered other peoples, and they discovered human beings who looked very different from the Western Europeans. And the question was, well, why do these humans look different? Other humans look different. Why do Australian Aborigines look different from the people who they were used to in France or Germany or the United Kingdom? Or people in Southern Africa or Western Africa looking slightly different as well? Was this a sign that after Darwin wrote, someone started asking the question, was this a sign that there were different processes of evolution? That the Aboriginal Australians may have evolved in a different way from the Europeans, from the Africans, from the South Americans, from the Chinese, and so on? Darwin, to his credit, always argued that this was implausible, that humans shared a common ancestry. Because, he said, the evidence suggests that humans, regardless of their look, regardless of whether they have lived as far as history knows in Africa or South America or Western Europe, they share similar cognitive structures and similar emotions. And above all, there was the experience I mentioned of him being taught by a slave, or a freed slave, but also on the Beagle, he had the experience of the Tierra del Fuegans, who lived in the south of South America. And the ship was actually taking back a group of Tierra del Fuegans back to their homeland. This was a group who lived in Britain for about 10 years, become highly westernized, all the latest English clothes, spoke English perfectly, were Tierra del Fuego English gentlemen and ladies. And Darwin could see that there was a sense of community between the English and the Tierra del Fuego. They were just like us, he said. But we'll come on to the but. So Darwin's argument, and it's always an argument, if you're going to argue for from evolutionary principles, if you're going to say, we've evolved to behave in this way. Men have evolved as hunters and they try and get as many women as possible. And women have evolved as nest builders and carers and they just want to have as many babies as possible. If you make this argument, you need to base it on universal characteristics. It's no good saying, shh, 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 shh. It's no good just saying, oh, we do this now. That would be an argument, but this happens in this culture. It's no good saying, we do this, and so do these people and these people, but these people don't. Once you start saying, oh, these people behave in different ways, you're saying, it's not universal, so it may not be produced by evolution. Because if you assume we all have the same evolutionary heritage, but if you're going to explain something in terms of that heritage, you must first of all, check that the behaviour, the characteristics which you wish to explain are universal to be found across history and across culture. And Darwin argues that all humans, apart from those who clearly have individual problems, but in every culture, you'll find humans with similar perceptual abilities, perceptual organs, and what we now would call cognitive architecture. Darwin did not use the term cognitive architecture, but it's a similar sorts of structures of mind. And these structures of mind for arguing, for noticing things, for having a sense of morality, have adaptive advantages. And above all, humans have language. Darwin points out, and this is very important, all humans have inherited the capacity for language. The Western imperialists, the missionaries, the travellers were going across the globe finding different sorts of societies at what they considered different levels of civilization. But one thing was common to all the societies which were found. There wasn't a single society without language. And often you'd have societies with their own language. And many of their languages of the so-called lower stages of civilization, societies which the travellers found in parts of Africa, even in Tierra del Fuego, not only had their own languages, but the languages were extremely complicated languages with much more complicated grammar than you found in Western languages. English, for instance, is a very uncomplicated language grammatically. And Darwin seized onto this in The Descent of Man. He understood the significance of this. But because of the universality of language, because wherever you go and you find humans, you find them talking, you find them inventing languages, using languages, it suggests the common evolution of humans. That humans must have evolved together and must have evolved as the language-using species. And then, after this, they separated and went across the world. They probably all started together in somewhere in Africa. And the evolution into becoming humans, i.e. the language using, tool using species, took place before they went across the globe. If it hadn't been, then you would have found some human societies without language. It's a very simple argument Darwin used, and a very, very important argument, and very significant one. And to understand Darwin, you really have to get this. And I'm happy to repeat it if anyone wants me to, and say, no, I just don't get why it's so important. No? Okay. And then, having spread across the globe, remember with Darwin, evolution never stops. And every generation will be slightly different from the previous generation. And then certain evolutionary processes take place to fit the body to the environment in which the body finds itself. Those who are living under conditions of great sunshine would develop, according to Darwin, darker coloured skin. Those who are living in extreme cold, like the Inuit, would develop bodies which can store fat more easily. And so on. And we begin, having spread across the globe, but certain characteristics have a greater chance of survival than other characteristics. But if you're well padded in a cold environment, you're more likely to survive than if you're very skinny, and the reverse if you're living in a very hot environment. And so humans spreading out develop different traits, different characteristics. But these are what Darwin says family resemblances. They're like, some dogs have longer ears than other dogs. Some have longer, bushier tails than other dogs. It is not a sign that these are different species, because the sign, the criterion for a species, is interbreeding. Can the species breed? And there was no evidence that there was any group of humans that could not breed with any other group of humans. In the same way that a dog with a bushy tail can breed with a dog with a very thin tail. So what was developing after we'd spread out were just surface trivial characteristics and differences, enabling better adaptation to physical conditions. These ideas have influenced later psychologists, and I just want to deal briefly with one of the great intellects. He's actually a linguist of modern times, Noam Chomsky, who's still alive. Has anyone talked about Chomsky's work? Have you talked to him? Well, you've had in, say, cognitive psychology, he's been mentioned, has he, or in language? No, but probably not the link to Darwin. No, let me do this. Chomsky, he was a rebel when he was younger, rebelled against behaviorism. He was a linguist, he rebelled against conventional linguistics. And he made the argument for what he called innate ideas, anti-lock. And he uses the Darwinian principle of looking for human universals and saying, if you find something which is universal amongst humans and human societies, then you are getting close to discovering what may be the innate structure of the human mind. And Chomsky, as a linguist, looked at all different languages. I won't say he looked at every language, but he made an argument that all languages have certain, what he called, universals. They possess universal features. And one feature which he stressed above all was that all known languages have grammars. Now, he's going on from Darwin, who said all humans have language, but he then didn't. Darwin wasn't a linguist and said, what is it about language? Chomsky says, the one thing about a language is it has a grammar. Now, what does he mean by this? Well, you think a language has words. Yes, all languages have words. But languages, according to Chomsky, are more than just collections of words. They involve rules about how you combine words to create sentences and to communicate. There is no language which is just a collection of words without rules of how to combine words, how to indicate plural, how to indicate singular, how to indicate past, present. And children learn and use grammatical rules. And they seem to acquire the grammatical rules, according to Chomsky, quite spontaneously. You teach a child a word, mama. You teach it dada. You teach it table. And soon the child is saying, mama's table, dada's table, or whatever way the language has for indicating ownership. And what this means is because there are grammatical rules in every language, and the rules differ. The languages don't have the same grammatical rules, but they have rules. That's Chomsky's point. Not we all have the same rules, but we all have rules. Because of this, that humans, regardless of where they live and what language they speak, can always understand sentences which they've never heard before. All of us are both speaking and hearing things which we've never heard before every day of our lives. And a new sentence doesn't create a problem for us. You could say, well, I've never heard this collection of words put together like this. It doesn't create a problem because we have the grammar which tells us how to decode the sentence, and for ourselves, how to create sentences which we've never heard and which have never been uttered before. And therefore, says Chomsky, and he considers himself very much Darwinian on this point, therefore, we have in our minds an innate structure for understanding and using grammar, the rules of grammar. Thus, the mind is not empty at birth. It has innate ideas. And Chomsky uses the term innate ideas very controversially. You could say innate potentiality for understanding grammatical rules. And of course, which grammatical rules will become evident depending on which language community the child grows up in. And the key proof, again, is universality. Go across the world. Wherever you find humans, you find language. And wherever you find language, you find rules for combining words, for decoding words. Not the same rules, but the nevertheless rules. And all this would be overthrown if anyone came up with an argument or an example of saying, look, this group of humans who get along very well and have a complex society, their language has no grammar, has no rules. It'd be like Popper and the black swan, the existence of a black swan, refuting the idea that all swans are white. But so far to this day, nothing like this has ever been found. Quite the reverse. There are some examples where children from different language groups have been taken out and lived together, they've been dispossessed, and it seems like the next generation will create their own new language with its own new rules. as if to be human is to have a grammar. Okay, Chomsky following on from Darwin. But Darwin's big question, one of the big questions he asked, was about emotions. This would take a bit longer. Bear with me, we've only got one lecture today. And if I do go on a bit, remember, I'm dealing with here very key questions about what it means to be human. And I'm also dealing with Darwin, with a great figure. Darwin is someone I've mentioned before, but in this course I want to introduce you to great thinkers. Not up-to-date thinkers necessarily, but thinkers whose ideas, it will pay you, it will be an advantage to you to carry about for the rest of your life. Look, if I give you a reference to the latest evolutionary psychology, and personally I don't think the standard of current evolutionary psychology is particularly high, I will be asking you to read something which will be out of date within 5 years. Darwin's Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals, published in 1872, is, in my view, still the most brilliant, the most insightful discussion about human emotions there has been. I cannot imagine, well, I can imagine, but I don't wish to imagine, that anyone could possibly read even a little bit of it and not have their thinking enhanced. But your thinking will be enhanced, because Darwin is a significant figure. Even if you think, no, I don't like Darwin, you should know what it is you don't like. And in this book, Darwin applied his evolutionary theory to the problem of emotions. And remember, when I quoted Marat saying, oh, it's a mystery why we all have similar emotions and why there's a similar physiological background to emotions. Darwin tries to explain. He gives an evolutionary argument that we've inherited physiological and behavioural characteristics for emotions. And what we've inherited has had in the past, not necessarily in the present, in the past, evolutionary advantage. And here, his arguments are based on observation, and particularly observing what is true of all humans. Remember, if he discovers a society where no one laughs, and there is no laughter, then he cannot have an evolutionary theory of why laughter has been inherited, and a plausible explanation of why universal characteristics might have evolved. And his ideas are based on close observation of close physiological reactions of how people react when they seem to have an emotion. And he collects stories from anthropologists, from travellers, from people who've been across the world, asking them, the peoples you knew in South America, West Africa, the heartlands of China or whatever, did they laugh when they were happy? Did they cry when they were sad? Did they blush when they were embarrassed? And he found out that almost universally people said yes. Yes, wherever you go, there's a commonality in emotional reactions. And look at the close physiological study. And for this, Darwin had an advantage, which observers in the previous century wouldn't have had. And it's clear in, if you look at Darwin's great book on emotions, what this advantage was. Can anyone imagine what discovery had made the study of emotions actually more realizable than it had ever been? Come on, you've got to come back from the error with Hobbes. Here's your chance. No, it's a simple one. It's that inventions in one field can affect another. It's similar. It's simple. By the time Darwin was publishing the expression of emotions, photography had become commonplace. And if you can take a picture of someone laughing or a picture of someone crying, you can freeze that moment and see how the face is, what muscles are being used. And inventions, technology of photography, of course, really has been important in the development of the psychology of emotions. And of course, he used cross-cultural information and his own experience of the Tierra del Fuegans. He knew they got excited just like Western Europeans got excited. But then you could say, well, they'd become Western Europeans. They were wearing the clothing of Western Europeans. Ah, when the Beagle docked, drew up in Tierra del Fuego, this small group of Tierra del Fuegans who had lived in England for the past few years and become celebrities in England, they got so excited. And they ran off the ship to see their families and friends. And as they ran across the beach, they threw off all the expensive Western so-called civilized garments. And they ran naked to their families. And they never went back to England again. And they became Tierra del Fuegans again. And Darwin then could see how the cultural differences, in his view, are superficial compared to the similarities between humans. That the same person could be an English gentleman and a Tierra del Fuegan leader, member, and have the same sorts of emotions and excitements and disappointments. But what the greatness of Darwin's book on emotions is that he's not really talking about the universality of emotional experience. Because what is it actually like to experience happiness as a dog or as a chimpanzee? Darwin makes an important shift, and it's there expressed in the title of his book. It's not the experience of the emotions which he's looking at primarily. It's the expression of how we behave. That people undergoing similar emotions express these emotions similarly. They display similar reactions. And with Darwin, you see a switch from the analysis of experience to the analysis of display or expression to behavior. And Darwin also notes similarities with animals. What is the sign of anger? Take a photograph of someone being angry, baring the teeth. And Darwin knows he lived among dogs. Dogs do the same. Wandering around London Zoo, primates do the same when they're angry. Why on earth should you bare the teeth when you're angry? And sometimes when you're angry or when you're frightened, the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. We talk about the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. And there's a tiny little, very weak physiological reaction amongst humans. It's much stronger in animals. And why do we open our eyes? Why, when we're surprised And this is a reaction. Surprise someone, and the eyes just open wide. Darwin never had photographs to show this. Why does the hair of some animal stand on end? And he asked the question, not why does that person do it, but could there be evolutionary advantages in this display when undergoing an emotion? And he says, yes. The emotional physiological system serves a function for human beings and a function which assists in survival. And that's why we have these displays of emotion and sometimes ones which really have outlived their usefulness, like the hair and that. And his arguments are always quite simple. Saying, originally, before these were part of a species reaction, it would happen that individuals willingly would engage in particular displays when they were in particular situations. If you were surprised, the cunning individual, instead of going, ooh, ooh, I'm surprised, ooh, ooh, I'm scared, ooh, 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 would look at them, I'm surprised, where, I heard a noise, is that someone out after, is that a tiger, a lion or whatever, and the eyes would open wide to see if there was danger. Now, Darwin says, that's more sensible than him. And the person who opens their eyes wide when surprised will have a better chance of avoiding the predator, the dangerous predator, than the person who goes, he doesn't quite put it like that, but I'm simplifying. And that means if there's a biological basis to opening your eyes wide, when even without thinking about it, as just a reaction to surprise, that reaction stands a better chance of surviving, leading to survival and adaptation, and therefore will be perpetuated over thousands upon thousands and thousands of years. Raising your hair standing out your back, when you're engaged in a dispute, well, it makes you look bigger. And if you look bigger, your foe will be less confident and you'll win your battle and therefore be able to perpetuate yourself. Exposing your teeth, that's threatening. Look at these big teeth that I've got. And again, it enables you to frighten off those who are threatening your life. And so Darwin says that originally these things had evolutionary advantage. And what is a successful habit becomes inherited, and those who inherit this reaction have a greater evolutionary advantage at a time when it mattered. Why do infants cry? Why is crying? What is the evolutionary significance for that? The argument is quite simple, according to Darwin. Our Shaftesbury, he notices that the human child is helpless for a long time. The child cannot speak. The newborn infant has no words. It can't even do complicated gestures. It can't snap its fingers and say, I want the breast now, please. Crying is a way of communicating discomfort, whether it's hunger, cold, warmth, too much warmth. Well, that's the cry. And the cry, and the child who doesn't cry has less chance of surviving. The parent who doesn't react to a cry, doesn't find the sound of an infant crying disturbing and distressful, has less chance of raising their child successfully. Why tears? You can just make a noise. And Darwin says, well, if you cry for a long period of time, the blood vessels in your eyes get engorged and the eyes dry out. The child who will cry, whose eyes will weep, has a better chance of preserving their sight and attracting attention. You see how Darwin argues of it's a plausible reason why this pattern of behaviour has adaptive advantage. But this behaviour has a function, not just in terms of the individual, but in terms of the species. And Darwin observed. He was, throughout his life, he was an observer. He liked looking, and he observed the physiology of emotions. And he observed his own children. He wrote a very famous paper, and I put it on the reading list, looking at one of his sons and one of his daughters over time, what they could do, how they reacted. He noticed there were similarities, he noticed that also there were differences. And he talks about, formulates what he writes, the principle of antithesis in communication. Why a difference between the happy and the sad face? Okay, the happy face, the child has to indicate to the parent when it feels content, and it has to indicate when it feels discontent. And Darwin looks at the physiology of the expression of content and discontent, and by and large, in discontent, all the muscles go down. Look mournful, it's all going down. In content, it's all going upwards. The face is moving in a different direction, the cheeks are compressed, the mouth goes upwards. And Darwin again says, this is no coincidence. Wherever you go across the world, people are just the same. Because it's not just important to display emotions for survival, but to display them as clearly as possible. So that the display for sadness will be the opposite of the display for happiness. So that caretakers will not be confused. One will be up and say, "Oh, it's crying. Is that crying or not? Oh, I can't really tell." No, it's got to be clear. And again, the clearer it is, the better the chance of survival. And don't forget, when Darwin was writing, infant mortality was still a huge, huge problem, as he knew to his great tragic experience. And his theory of evolution depended on the assumption that infant mortality across different species, and certainly within humans, was a continual problem and a continual precondition for evolution. And so there were the principle of antithesis, there's an advantage for the displays of emotion to be very different and different from each other. What we have in Darwin's book on emotions and in his book on the Descent of Man is a revolutionary theory of psychology. It doesn't appear revolutionary now, but in his day it was revolutionary. A very different way of looking at human beings. The importance of inheritance, but the history of the species was affecting current behaviour. And the history of the species should, if I'm properly understood, unite us, not separate us. And there's an important method for the evolutionary hypothesis. Is behaviour universal? If it is universal, then it is unlikely to be produced by social factors. over social factors become a means of perpetuating something which is universal. This is Chomsky's argument about grammar and language. And here I join with modern evolutionary psychologies. Here, where I think modern evolutionary psychology is so unsatisfactory. I've put an article on the reference list, which is quite an interesting one, of why young men seem to give more to charity in the presence of young women. And the argument is they wish to impress the young women, and giving to charity is a way of impressing the young women. That is probably quite correct. But they then don't say, well, this tells us something about how young men behave in our society. They then say, and this must be for evolutionary reasons. And here is an example of where you take just one finding and give an evolutionary explanation for that one finding. But of course you could, with a bit of imagination, give a cultural explanation. The evolutionary explanations, in my view, become important when you don't just take one finding, but you look at its universality. Because this is like Popper and the importance of refutation. If you find examples where so-called what is evolutionary significant doesn't occur, it means that your evolutionary hypothesis doesn't work. Maybe it's been refuted. And this raises a very, very important issue of why humans are different. It's very easy to say that we have an evolutionary background which determines what we do, and particularly in turn determines principles of sexual selection. But Darwin was aware that there is one aspect of humans which makes us so different from every other animal which is struggling to adapt to its environment. Can anyone just, come to me and say what that one feature is and why human adaptation to the environment is so different any other animals or species' adaptation to the environment? It's simple. We are the one species above all who doesn't have to adapt to the existing environment. It seems to be part of our nature and talents that we can change environment. We can control the environments in which we live. We can change the environment. So the principle of adapting to an existing environment is not the only principle at work with human beings. We create societies, we create civilizations, we create environments. Goodness knows the problem we're in at the moment, how we've wrecked the earth and its resources. We will be, in your generation, be in huge trouble unless we show how we can create new environments for ourselves to live in. No other animal can do this. Not even our near neighbours, the chimpanzees. And certainly not the higher mammals, the dogs and the cats. Only the humans can destroy environments and recreate environments. And that's why our adaptation is very different. Okay, that's enough of this. Questions. We have a couple of minutes. No? This has gone on for longer than I thought.